you up with a little Napoleon being defeated at the gates of Moscow. 1812 overture, Tchaikovsky, written for the 70th anniversary of the defeat of Napoleon by the Russians in 1812. A little bit of history. Goes really well with Enigma. So, just a little funny story that I'll enter. I went to the Mozart Festival, which was in Royce Hall. And, yeah, we're getting that little bleed back again today. And this was on Sunday night. You know, the average age is about 163. And what I don't understand is this performance by this wonderful pianist. And, you know, there's no students because each ticket costs about $70 a piece, which is, it's just criminal to not have seats for students on a performance in Royce Hall. You know, have like $10 or $15 seats, you know, who knows where. But I don't know how many of you ever had classes or graduation or honors or any of that stuff in Royce Hall, but there's like one bathroom. It's like going into Cleveland Memorial Stadium, you know, with 85,000 fans after a football game, and try and go in the men's bathroom. The line is 18 miles long, and you're lucky if you can find a garbage can, which is a little bit more convenient, at least for guys. But the point here is that the line is a mile long, and I'm standing there, and you can't get back in, you know, unless you get there quickly. And I'm going, man, how did they design this place with just one men's toilet? And this guy behind me who was, I mean, this guy was, he was older than Methuselah. And he puts his arm around me and he says, young man, young man. Well, I was young compared to him. He goes, young man, you're standing behind a bunch of old guys with enlarged prostates. Please be patient. And I was going, oh, God. Yeah, right. All the guys in this room are going to be looking forward to that, I'll tell you. I never believed it until I have to get up 15 times a night to pee, but that's never here nor there. Only your professor will tell you. So, are there any questions? Yeah.
Was it UCLA
Nick.
Live event?
Pardon?
Was it UCLA Live?
It's one of those live perform, you know.
Did they have $10 or $15
student tickets all of them? No, this wasn't UCLA Live. This was one of the UCLA performance series where they contract these people that come in. It's a little bit different series. Any questions? Comments? Questions about anything? Yeah. Can't hear you.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was wondering up until what chapter we're supposed to have read.
Can you speak up just a little bit more?
Until what chapter are we supposed to read or have read by this
point? It's all in the syllabus. It's all outlined very clearly and nicely and outlined chapter by chapter and discussion by discussion and dinner by dinner and everything else. God, where's Josh? And Lisa. Where's Lisa today? You must have scared her away on Saturday. What were you guys doing on Saturday afternoon when I bumped into you? God, huh? What were you guys doing? Big entourage. Huh? Surprised you guys, huh? You were at Whole Foods. Oh, God. Let's not even go there. Let's not even go there. Okay, what? How is my, yeah, they're very expensive, but, yeah, I was having a good time, anyways, as you could tell. So, what we want to do today is a couple of things, and let me get my slides on, because I have some usual announcements, and we're going to have a little bit of fun, because today you're going to do a real experiment, and right in class. So, let me remind myself, tomorrow I have the Kyoto contingent coming. You don't know what the Kyoto contingent is, but this is actually the long-distance learning classroom of which they built but didn't have enough money to put the equipment in for long-distance learning, but then proceeded to ask me whether I could cough up $150,000 in order to put the screens and everything in, which I'm going to do sometime this spring or summer. And why? Because I teach this class called the Kyoto class, which I taught. When was it, Tomo, a year ago or 2 years ago? where I have 50 students at Kyoto University in Japan and 45 students here, and it's all real-time, open fiber optics, TV screens everywhere. And then halfway through the quarter, about, 15 kids I send over to Japan, and 15 Japanese or 20 kids come here, and we trade off in the whole thing. It's a whole interactive thing. And I was going to do it this year for you guys, but the agreement ran out between Kyoto University and the University of California. So this big contingent is coming tomorrow and at 11 in the morning. So I apologize. I won't have office hours, as Tomo will be walking around and translating for me so we can get this. But it's a lot of fun. It's a very, very unique way to teach, because you're calling on people. I'm calling on people on a screen in Japan, and they have microphones, and they interact with you guys here, and they have an electronic blackboard where you can go up and work together just like we do in here, and it's a very clever thing. But anyways, I heard there was a big contingent in office hours this week. Please keep coming. Thursday is our first guest speaker, Dr. Alan McEwen, and he's a very unusual guy. I'll tell you a little bit more about him on Thursday. He's a Canadian. He's a plant molecular biologist. He's a biotechnologist. And he has written an award-winning book on genetically modified plants, which I'll tell you about in a second. But what we're doing is that I'm going to show a film, and then he'll talk for about an hour, and then there'll be questions and answers from the class, and then we're going to have a reception with, you know, munchies and cheese and Cokes and stuff outside on this patio catered by UCLA Catering for all of you to interact with Alan McEwen. And then those of you that are scheduled to go for dinner, I'm assuming they RSVP'd, Jessica? Please RSVP. This is a big deal. And those of you who are scheduled to go to dinner will be going to dinner with Alan on Thursday. Now, who is Alan McEwen? So he's a guy who's a cooperative extension biotechnologist. That's a mouthful. Cooperative extension is a very old component of the Department of Agriculture. And what extension specialists do, and this originated in the 20s, is they go around and they teach farmers the latest techniques and stuff like that in terms of how to grow their crops and plants and everything. But more in an urbanized setting, these cooperative extension individuals go around and explain to the public new technology. And so Alan is really an expert at explaining the benefits and perhaps some of the risks, if any, of genetic engineering. And that's all he does, really. And he teaches this to students like you at UC Riverside. But he's been involved in just about every debate and an initiative of banning genetically modified animals and plants in California. And he's a very soft-spoken but very thoughtful individual, and he has a lot to say. He wrote this book, Pandora's Picnic Basket, on the risks and benefits of genetically modified foods. It won Canadian Science Writers Award. It's a very special book. But more than that, he was on the National Academy of Sciences commission on the safety of genetically engineered foods. And for those of you who don't know what the National Academy of Sciences are, the National Academy of Sciences was created in 1865 by Abraham Lincoln. And the National Academy of Science was then put into action by Congress. And the purpose of the National Academy of Sciences is twofold. One, to, quote, honor the nation's best scientists, whatever that means. And two, and to provide advice and consent to Congress and the president on scientific issues. And this is the body of individuals that advises the president and Congress on everything from environmental pollution to stem cells to genetically modified plants, release of genetically modified organisms to the environment, seat belts. I mean, anything you could ever imagine that deals with really cutting-edge scientific issues, the National Academy of Sciences participates in. And there's only 1,500 members of the National Academy of Sciences. It's fixed. There's a few foreign associates, but there's 1,500. That's worldwide. And some of the people who were members of the National Academy of Sciences include Watson and Crick and Einstein and Louis Pasteur and a bunch of others. So it's a pretty distinguished body of folks, and I'll talk about one of them today. In any case, this can be downloaded, or you can read parts of it, which will be relevant for your discussion tomorrow. You just go to the National Academy Press online, and it's PDF, it's free, you can read it, you can download it, and it's a really, it's an excellent, very balanced, very fair, very objective, because all these committees that do these things have representatives of both the National Academy, representatives who are not members of the National Academy, and sometimes people who are lay people and people who are not in favor of things that the Academy might be in favor of, but it is a pretty remarkable organization. I'll say more about that later on. And so come prepared to ask Alan very, very good questions. And that means that it dovetails the discussion for tomorrow, which will be on transgenic animals and transgenic plants and using those animals and plants to make drugs and why they're used to make drugs as opposed to, let's say, bacteria, which you had in discussion last week. And text chapters 6, 7, 12, and 13, I think, those are the relevant chapters, but it's also on your syllabus, and be prepared for a really good discussion. I mean, a discussion of the issues, but again, no opinions. If you have, you know, feelings one way or the other, please back it up and substantiate what you have to say, because Gloria and Mike will be looking for that. When you leave for the double helix essay, it's not really an essay. I don't want to scare you. It's not one of these 40-page papers that one hears about. It's actually very simple, and it is on the double helix, and I hope all of you have finished that book. How many of you finished it? How many? Well, it's fun, huh? You know, just how long did it take you to read? An afternoon or two at the most? Moves fast. Sometimes you can't put it down. I know I've read it about 20 times, but it's I learn things every time I read it that I hadn't thought about before. Please read it. You'll have to write something on it. There's two parts to this quote essay. The main part, which is 80%, is just really sort of objective kinds of things about what they did and how DNA structure was discovered. And then the second part, which is the essay part, it's really an abstract. And the abstract is perhaps one of the most difficult things to write, because you're going to have to take a position and defend it in 400 words. And that's what we do all the time as scientists. We write abstracts on our papers, and sometimes those are the things that take us more time than anything else, because we have to put everything that we want to say in a very, very short amount of space. So I did this on purpose as a challenge to see whether you could come up with something in a short space. Okay, bacterial cloning experiment. When you leave, there'll be another thing here. It'll say bacterial cloning experiment, and you'll need to write a lab report on the experiment that you're doing today, because that's what we do again. Although this lab report is something where you can get a fast 20,000 bonus points, and so it's not something that is part of the regular points, it's part of bonus points. You know what that is? I know what it is. It's my eye music that I didn't shut off. I did that in a lecture once. In any case, pick that up, and there's some guidelines for it. And it's an actual lab report. You can write this thing up. And when you write it up, you'll get extra bonus points depending upon the outcome of the experiment. It's self-explanatory, but it has to do with what the results of your experiment were. And you'll have to draw some figures and explain it and validate and test and do all kinds of things, but you get bonus points for that. And keep in mind that this class does give you lab demonstration credit, and so what you're doing today is part of the reason why it gives you lab demonstration credit for GE. Okay, what I'm going to do is see if I have anything else to say before I turn the floor over. Yeah, we're going to talk about genes and stuff today, but I don't need to do that. So what I'm going to do is to turn the floor over to Gavino. Is that what the plan is, or is it to Gloria, or to both of you guys? Okay, so Gloria and Mike, they're going to come down here, and they're going to lead you in an experiment. And what I want you to do is to pay attention to what they're going to tell you to do, and to do exactly what they're going to tell you. And they're going to write on the board, 1, 2, 3, 4, exactly what you have to do.
All right, guys.
Got it?
Yeah. Can you hear me? All right, guys, you should all have 3 plates, some parafilm, aluminum foil toothpicks, a Sharpie, and some tubes that are labeled A, B, and C. So if anyone doesn't have that, tell me right now, and we'll get you whatever you're missing.
Does everyone have everything? Guys ready to roll? Okay, go ahead.
So what we want you to do is first take your plates, divide each plate into 3 regions and with your
Sharpie. You're
going
to have to show them how to do that,
right,
Mike.
That's what Gloria's going to be doing. So, Gloria,
go ahead.
Divide the plate into 3 regions with your Sharpie. And then label them 1, 2, and 3. Yes. They don't have to be really equal now.
The right pens. Jessica, these aren't the right pens. You wanted Sharpies, not Sharpies.
So label all 3 plates.
The felt Sharpies that we
used.
No, not on. Oh, you mean on which side of the plate? This side right here is fine. The side that's facing up is fine. Yes. Right, and make sure you keep, don't take the lids off or anything right now, and make sure you keep each lid with its appropriate plate.
Yeah, you don't want to cough all over these things and you'll have some really interesting results. Now, what this is a pseudo, well, it's not pseudo, it's actually a cloning experiment. And you'll be working with live bacteria here. Of which are in the tubes that you have in these racks. So what's the next step, Professor?
So you guys, hopefully you've labeled your plates now, as Gloria did very nicely.
And please put your initial on each of these plates, or your name, or whatever, and you can put it anywhere you want so that they're identifiable.
So you guys will notice that your plates, one of them has no tick mark on the other side, one of them has 1 tick mark, one of them has 2 tick marks. So what we want you to do, let's start with the one that has no tick marks on the opposite side. You have toothpicks wrapped in aluminum foil. I want you guys to unwrap that and choose your favorite toothpick of the 3. The one that has no tick marks on the opposite side, please. Yes.
And again, keep
so
your hands off the...
If you guys need demonstration, watch Gloria. She is showing you.
So all been sterilized.
So make sure that you only handle 1 end of the toothpick. Leave the other end free of your fingers. And once you have your toothpick, you guys each have 3 tubes, as I already said. Go ahead and take tube A and streak that.
No, Mike, forgot the most important step.
What step am I forgetting?
Shake.
So take your bacteria. You really don't have to, but...
Flicking.
These guys right here. You have 3 tubes. Go ahead and shake your tubes. Make sure that it's mixed.
Flick it with your finger. Watch
so,
Gloria.
Gloria, yeah, go ahead and show.
Get it really good or your bacteria will all be down on the bottom. Flick it really good. It's called shake. How does it go, Jessica? How does it sing it?
No, that's all right.
Okay.
All right, that should be sufficient.
What?
Now, what I want you guys to do is take your toothpick, open up that
container.
We're flicking
which one, Mike?
Tube A, please. So take tube A, open that tube up.
With 1 thumb.
If you can do it with 1 thumb, if you can't,
just
you can use
2 hands. One hand, just flip it. If you can.
If anyone needs
not,
any help.
Use the other.
Then go ahead and dip the clean end of your toothpick in there. And then, Gloria, why don't you show them how they can make artwork on their plates? So we're using the first plate still, which is...
So you're using the plate without the tick mark.
You want to turn it over.
And you got bacteria on there, and you can dip again if you have to. And you want to streak it on that plate in each of those 3 sectors. Is that correct, Mike?
No. Just the first section. Section one or A, however you happen to label it.
So just in one section.
You can do whatever you want. You can draw a picture. You can streak one line.
So go over it again, Mike.
So, Gloria, so you guys have your toothpick that you just dipped in the tube. You have the first plate that you've chosen that has no tick marks on it. And you want to streak your toothpick. Yes, you want to flip over your plate. So your plates right now, this is the side that is facing you. Turn them over and lift the lid up. You should then be facing the actual gel of the plate. And what you want to do then is streak the appropriate region with your toothpick. Yes.
You better dip in there again to make sure you got bacteria. Don't let it dry.
You don't need that much, but if you want to put more to be safe, that's fine. You guys can put as much as you want. You can draw little designs, like I said, little heart. All right, so has everyone gotten through that okay? You're doing okay, Charles? What's that? You don't have to pierce the gel. All you have to do is just streak it on there.
You don't want to pierce it. That's exactly what you don't want to do.
You don't want to do that. Just skim it along the surface. Draw a little picture. Okay? Has everyone done that? Is everyone okay with that? It's not a big deal. Don't worry too much. Just...
Okay, Mike.
Take that same toothpick now. You're using still tube A, and you want to go ahead now and do the other two plates the exact same way in the same labeled region. Yes. What's that? Yes. So you guys are doing exactly what you just did, but you're doing it with the opposite two plates now. Yeah, just go ahead and dip it in there and then streak it on the plate. There's no need to stab the gel or dig in there. As long as you touch it to the gel, that's plenty. You what? Didn't even touch it with your finger? Should be okay. Just condensation problem.
Okay, and then when you're done with that, you can go to B, and you can go to C,
exactly,
and follow the same program, mix it up, go in with a different toothpick, streak B on all of the different plates, and when you're done with that, go ahead, Mike.
All right, when you guys are done with the toothpick for a particular tube, just go ahead and do what Jennifer did and just leave it in the tube.
Leave it in the tube. Don't put it down on the desk.
Pardon? Oh, you should. It's not terribly important, but... So now you're repeating the same thing again with tubes B and C and all three of the plates. Exactly. So you should have A, B, and C, and you should have regions either A, B, and C or a 1, 2, and 3. So you want to make sure that you streak the same tube in the same region each time. Samantha, is it going okay there? Doing good? Ben? How's it going, Kyle? Got it? Got it, Becca?
Okay, how many of you are through with B? You wrap up B.
And then moving on to C, doing the exact same thing with the third region.
Mike,
so they're taking this toothpick into tube C. You're going to streak it onto region C of your plate, of all three plates, and then leave the used toothpick in the tube as you've done with the previous two.
Don't forget to mix up your bacteria.
How's everyone doing in the back? How you doing, Brian? Good? Got it? Delicious. So how's everyone doing with C? Are you guys almost done with that yet? Who's done with C so far? Okay.
Sky, you done? Good. Summer, you done?
Make sure proper technique.
Nayla, you done? Great. Jennifer, you done? Good. Done, Kyle? That's cool.
So, is everyone done at this point, or a few people still? We can wait a minute.
Done, Josh? Okay, next step, Mike. Right. Take them through it one by one.
Okay, used all of your tubes, all of your toothpicks. Your plates should be closed. You have your initials. They're labeled. You have 3 strips of parafilm in front of you. Now take one of those strips. There's 1 for each plate. What you're going to do is what I'm about to show you. Gloria, you can narrate.
So you just separated the parafilm from the back of the wax paper.
So there's parafilm, piece of the wax paper. Separate it.
Yep.
Take your plate as I'm holding it here.
And you run it along the edge, see, like that?
So
this is a seal it.
I'm going to hold it down on one side, and then begin to stretch it around the edge of the plate.
It's stretchy, so just pull it along, yeah. Get it?
Watch Tomo.
Like Karina there, good. So it might be easier to do what Tomo's doing right there, which is just to pull it out and then wrap it. It's okay.
Make sure it's sealed real well. You don't want them to fall apart in your backpack. Like my Coke did the other day when it blew up in my backpack.
You got it, Jordan? You guys good? Yeah.
Stretch
so now,
it and make it tight.
Once you guys have it tight around that first plate, you're going to go ahead and repeat that exact same thing with the other 2 plates, seal all 3 of them up.
Good.
Doing okay over here? Josh, looking good.
I get this philosophy major Rudita. Working in my lab.
Very nice. Very
2
nice.
Of them here sitting next to
Brian,
each other.
Brian, very nice. How's it going up here, Kyle? Piece of cake. Anton, you okay back here? You got it sealed up tight?
Seal it like a coffin. If you need any help,
Another one?
Good.
If you guys tear it, don't worry, that's fine. We have tons of parafilm.
Good.
And if you need help, just raise your hand or call on one of us.
Cool stuff, isn't it?
I think when I did this, when I was in this class, I tore the parafilm several times.
And everyone laughed. Remember, Gavino?
It was embarrassing.
Fell off your chair.
I think I had someone help me. I think one of my TAs helped me with it.
Okay, is everyone done? Didn't give Jessica her plates. Didn't give Jessica some plates. Mike?
Jessica.
I did it last
year. Did you?
There's 3 right here. How's everyone doing? Everyone good? They all sealed up?
Parafilm. Okay, is everyone done? Mike?
Okay, so you guys are going to take those home and live with them. Keep them in a warm place. You can sleep with them if you'd like. Keep them under your pillow. Usually want to leave them with your labeled side up. And watch what happens. And you guys want to pay attention to what happens. We're going to have your handout. We'll have all the appropriate information that you need.
Okay, so this is an experiment designed to teach you how to think about, in a very, very small and simple way, about what you did and about what the results might mean. So you're going to get some observations. There's three different plates because they've been marked differently, one with nothing, one with one tick, one with two ticks. You have three different strains of bacteria, and you've struck them on this plate in which have all the ingredients in which these bacteria need to grow. So it looks like it's just a golden agar, but it has vitamins, minerals, and sugar, and carbon, and nitrogen. Hydrogen is all the substances that are necessary for these things to grow. And you're going to take these plates home, and you want to put them in a relatively warm place. And warm does not mean, you know, 500 degrees. It means, you know, body temperatures. That means like under your pillow or on the top of your refrigerator or something like that. That's not that cold. So you can sleep with them because these are bacteria that like to grow at body temperature. So you can keep them close to you at night. And probably in about a day, maybe Thursday, hopefully, you'll see some results. And the little bacterial cloning experiment report is due Friday, but if your bacteria haven't grown, that's okay. You can hand it in on Monday or Tuesday. That's not a problem. Tomo, do you want to show them how to use the paraffin to hold the three plates together or not?
No.
Okay. So now, where's the garbage bag? Just throw your stuff in.
Yeah, there's extra parafilm. We'll take it. Unless you guys want to take it home with you, and that's fine.
Now, if anyone wants any extra plates that you can just hack right into and see what happens, be my guest. You can just cough, spit, hack, do anything you want. I knew there's always a couple in this class. And you'll actually notice that there'll probably be a very big difference in what you'll see on this hacking plate. And there's some other plates here, too. Anyone wants any. Just do whatever you want. Hacker.
Just can.
Mm-hmm. More extra plates right here.
You might get different results depending upon what you take. You never know. Going once, going twice. Loda. There you go. Do two. Wrap them up with some paraffin. Yeah. Any more parafilm? Only takes a half hour. Get this crap out of here. If you're not using it, get rid of it. Get it away from me.
Just take it off completely?
Yeah. And then flag me down. Put it on the floor or something, okay? What's this? Gloria?
Gloria, sir.
Okay.
I don't want to see it.
Okay. Any questions about this at all? Three plates, three strains of bacteria, and warm them up, give them good love, and see what happens. And if you have any questions, email me or Gloria or Mike regarding what you're supposed to see or what you haven't seen. Keep the plate that you've, the part of the plate in which you've put the magic marker on, up so that the auger is facing down. That's to prevent condensation. So that any condensation you get will go away from the bacteria, rather up into it, so that it mushes up everything that you've done. Anything else, Gloria? Is that it? Mike? Is that it? Positive? Good job. A lot of work to put this together, and Mike and Gloria and Tomo and everyone did a, this is really not trivial to say, just to manage all of this, and so we're very, very, very appreciative. How many of you ever done this before? Hand? How many have not ever worked with anything live? That's what I thought. Good. Okay, let's forge on and pick up some conceptual stuff. Gloria, I don't want to come down with cancer here. Okay, genetic engineering, as you know, as should be abundantly obvious from everything that we've said the last couple of weeks, involves manipulating genes. And we've talked a little bit about what genes are all about and what they do, and you've talked about it in discussion, you've thought about it a little bit, and you've had some quizzes on it, but you don't really know, for the most part, what genes really do. And you don't really have, so far, historical flavor on the origins of genetic engineering. And you don't really quite know, but you do know, but you don't know something about what genes are made of, but how they're organized and how they're on chromosomes, and what is so natural about doing genetic engineering and, in fact, working with genes from a process or a biological point of view. I said that it's no hocus pocus. I'm going to come back to that, and it should be abundantly obvious after this lecture and the next lecture and discussion that we'll have, that we're dealing with pretty normal cellular processes where we're not waving any magic wands, we're not really doing anything, we're just intervening in a process by using the same process. And so let me just refocus on what genes do and what they're all about. And Jessica, I think I need my pointers. And so let's just talk about the process of what genes are. We talked about this last week, but I'm going to recapitulate it for you. There's two things that we talked about and we had discussion about in class that genes do. The first thing is that they replicate and they pass on the directions for specific traits from generation to generation to generation. And that should be obvious from everything that we've discussed and everything that we've said. It should be obvious that one of the most fundamental principles of a gene, if not what distinguishes this biological substance from anything else, is the fact that it can replicate. It can self-replicate and pass its blueprint or its instructions down from generation to generation. So that's the first thing. And so the sum total of all the genes in an organism is called the genotype. And you may have heard this or not, but it's called the genotype. So the genes, all the genes on the chromosome of an organism, the set of the genes, is called the genotype. The second function of this gene is to direct some process inside the cell. And you know that, like hair color, eye color, skin color, good enzymes so someone doesn't have phenylketonuria, whatever, but that is to direct the production of what I'll call the phenotype, or the outward appearance of a trait. And so it could be red cabbage versus green cabbage, as we've talked about. It could be broccoli-type flower versus cauliflower-type flower. It could be a variety of different things, but those are under the control of genes. So one is to replicate and pass this identical trait on from generation to generation, and two, to be able to specify some function in a very precise way inside the cell. And so we have replication, we have gene action, and we have the function. And the function comes at the end of a very long process of which you'll become reasonably well familiar with in a couple of weeks. And so that is what genes are all about. But the question really arises, something I just love talking about, as you'll see, is how is this proven experimentally? And so I gave you some insights into how this was proven experimentally last week and the week before. And those insights came from experiments that were carried out reasonably, you know, in the present, not more than 10 or 15 years ago. And those were the glowfish experiment and the supermouse experiment and changing the sex of the mouse experiment and the insect-resistant plant and the glow plant, all those things as we discussed in here. And we don't have to go through the same discussion because we're going to have a slightly different one in a historical concept. Really indicated that genes were DNA and that these pieces of DNA were able to function and replicate and direct a new process inside a cell. But from a historical point of view, these experiments go back almost 80 years. 80 years. And the question was slightly different about 80 years ago. And the question really was nothing to do with DNA, and nothing to do with proteins, and nothing to do with anything with respect to biology, but the questions really were, what was the nature of a disease? And so the origins of genetic engineering and the origins of what genes are didn't start because someone was looking for what a gene is. It started because someone was looking for what the origins and what the pathology of a particular disease was, and that disease was pneumonia, which was literally killing millions of people around the turn of the century. And so the origins of what the genetic material is and the foundation for all of Watson and Crick's work came from a variety of places, but mainly from the origins of experiments that took place about 80 years ago. And much of the terminology that was coined 80 years ago, you are using in this class. And that's why I'm going to go over what these fascinating experiments were. So the point is that I think you know what genes are, and I think you have some idea of how they specify particular traits, and I think that you have some idea of what the processes of how genes work are from a crude point of view. But from a historical point of view, you don't have any really appreciation for the science that was done to give us this really quantum leap in biology and information. So let me just set the stage. Stage, let's say, goes back 80 years. Turn of the century, Mendel's principles were rediscovered, as we talked about last week. People started to understand that genes could be transmitted from generation to generation, and Mendel's principles, which are not important to go into here, Mendel's laws were rediscovered and were applied to plants and animals and humans, and all kinds of creatures. And people were doing classical genetics, a lot of experiments. Some of you saw them in that film we showed in discussion a couple of weeks ago, where they were finding out that genes were on chromosomes and finding out that genes were strung along chromosomes and finding out that there were all kinds of interesting things that genes could mutate. All of these things that you take for granted now were all done by experiments done at the beginning of the 20th century. But at the same time, there was also a revolution going on in medicine. People were learning about the origins of very horrible diseases. They were learning about what viruses were all about. They were learning about what bacteria were all about. And they were also learning about the origins of biochemistry and organic chemistry. So what I'm saying here is that this flurry of scientific work at the turn of the 20th century had a lot to do with the origins of microbiology, the origins of organic and biochemistry, the origins of genetics. All of this was going on in parallel at the same time, in different laboratories and in different places, and it all converged to
20, 30 years later, as you will see. And many of these labs were working in isolation with one another. But what was known, let's say, in the beginning of the 20th century about genes? Well, and again, I want you to appreciate, as you will see, and I'm harping on this, that all of this was done by very specific experiments that were carried out using the scientific method that I summarized on your handout that I'm not going to go over again. But all these were done by very specific experiments. But some of it was done just by accident. And I'm going to tell you a story about an accident in a few minutes. But let me take it step by step. So what was known, around, the beginning, mid-20th century, was that genes were located on chromosomes. What was known was that genes were individual units, meaning a gene specified a trait, like hair color, eye color. That was known. It was also known that probably genes had some biochemical basis, but the basis of it was really not known. It could have been a protein, could have been a nucleic acid, could have been RNA, could have been DNA, could have been a variety of things, but it was not known what it was. It was just these magical things on these chromosomes that directed specific traits. And as we discussed in this class, these scientists knew that it directed traits because of mutation. If it's not for mutation and genetic variability, we wouldn't know that there were the existence of any genes. And so the point here is that they knew that there were these substances on chromosomes. They didn't know what they were. They knew that they followed the laws of heredity. They knew they were passed on from generation to generation. They knew that they were responsible for horrific diseases. They knew that they could use these things, to make better plants, et cetera, et cetera. But they didn't have any idea of what the nature, the molecular, the chemical nature of the gene is, nor were they absolutely convinced in the case of higher organisms whether genes were in the nucleus or whether genes were in the cytoplasm. They assumed they were in the nucleus because the chromosomes were transmitted from generation to generation. And the chromosomes were in the nucleus, but that was by inference. There hadn't really been an experiment that demonstrated directly that these things are on these chromosomes in the nucleus. They were sort of, they're probably there. We're almost convinced they're there. I'll see you later, Matt. But they weren't really absolutely convinced from an experimental point of view. And so let me just tell you about a few little experiments that I love to talk about. They addressed three different kinds of questions, but had to be done experimentally. And they lie in the origins of what I've been talking about for the last few weeks. The first experiment addresses the issue of whether or not the genes reside on chromosomes in the nucleus. One could infer that from observation. One could look at it. One could say that they were. But what about a very specific and elegant experiment that actually demonstrated it beyond a shadow of a doubt? That's the first experiment. Second experiment dealt with the issue of whether all genes are in all cells, meaning you know that all organisms, higher organisms, have specialized cells. They have liver cells and heart cells, and one could say that perhaps these cells are different because they have different genes for whatever reason. They all start with the same complement of genes, but as they develop and change, some genes are lost, and all the different cells of, let's say, a human or an animal have different complements of genes. So I'm going to show you an experiment that demonstrates that that's not the case. And in fact, that's the origins of human cloning, mammalian cloning, cloning cows, cloning cattle, and very important for things you'll read in discussion and for genetic engineering. But finally, I'm going to go into perhaps one of the most incisive, it's actually two, series of experiments that actually will demonstrate that DNA is the genetic material. And the experiments that Watson and Crick used to say it's got to be in the DNA, it's obvious, and it's not proteins. And so I'm going to go through these experiments, and you'll see exactly why, because they teach you how to think about science, but they also underpin a lot of the things that we're talking about in this class. So the first question becomes, if you have a complex multicellular organism, such as a human being, and they have a cell with a cytoplasm and a nucleus, do the genes reside in the nucleus or do they reside in the cytoplasm? And there's this wonderful botanist by the name of Hamerling who carried out this wonderful experiment in the 1940s with algae, in which he addressed that question in a very specific way. And this is a very classical, very important experiment in genetics, in biology, and here's what he did. There were a couple different varieties of this unicellular algae called Acetabularia. It's a wonderful organism. It has one cell, but it's quite big. And the unique feature of this particular alga is that the nucleus, as you can see, is in the foot or the bottom of the algae, and the top or the cap of the algae has a particular shape. This is one cell. All of this is one cell. It's a unicellular organism. And different, let's say, varieties or different species of this organism have a different shaped cap, as you can see. So Hamerling looked at this issue, and he hypothesized that perhaps the genetic information is in the nucleus. And so if that was the case, if the genetic information is in the nucleus, then the nucleus must dictate the shape of the cap. In other words, some information, let's say in the genes, in the nucleus, would then direct the functioning and shape and production of the cap. It's obvious to us now. But when Hamerling did this in the early 1940s, it wasn't so obvious. But it was a hypothesis that the genetic information resided in the nucleus. So he took these two varieties of single-celled algae, and the prediction was that if and only if the genes are in the nucleus, if he cut off the top, that is the cap of these algae, and he transplanted a little bit of, let's say, the brown algae to the green and the green algae to the brown, so we have it right here. We've cut the caps off. We've now transplanted part of the brown algae to the green, part of the green algae to the brown, but there's no cap because we've cut it off. The prediction was that if the genes are located in the nucleus at the foot of these algae, when the cap regenerates, which it does, the shape of the cap will follow the nucleus from which this particular algae was derived. So that means that the brown foot with the brown nucleus should give rise to this round fan-shaped cap, or the green nucleus in the green foot should give rise to this more curled up, not widespread umbrella-like cap. So it was a transplantation experiment, and it gave rise to very specific predictions from the hypothesis that the genetic information was in the nucleus, and the results would be very clear-cut. In other words, if the genetic information was, let's say, somewhere up here in the cytoplasm rather than down here, then you'd expect to get this brown-type cap. But if the genetic information resided in the nucleus at the foot, then you'd expect to get this green kind of cap. And what Hamerling showed, beyond a shadow of a doubt, was, yes, his hypothesis was validated, correct, in that the nucleus type dictated the type of the shape of the cap. And that suggested, although one could perhaps say otherwise, suggested that, in fact, the genetic information resides somewhat in the nucleus and dictates, let's say, the phenotype or the shape of the algae. Chris, what's wrong with one of Hamerling's conclusions? Would you accept it unambiguously?
I suppose not. I'm.
Here's the nucleus right there. There's the nucleus right there.
Okay.
So Hamerling concluded that it was the nucleus that directed the shape of the cap. And his experiment, that his transplantation experiment, came out based on what his predictions were. But what could be an alternative explanation for this? Nothing's unambiguous. What could be an alternative but maybe reasonable explanation?
I don't know. Can I ask?
Well, think about it. Sure you know. Look at the shape of the foot. Is that nucleus residing by itself down there?
There.
What's around it?
Lots of other cells.
Not other cells. I said this is a single-celled organism.
Sorry.
What else would be around it?
Proteins?
Might be proteins. Might be something else, correct?
Yeah.
The nucleus isn't just sitting there in space by itself, correct?
Right.
There's something else around it. So all Hamerling did was to cut off this part of the algae, take that brown thing and put it there, and then he got a green cap. So what could be an alternative explanation, Melissa?
I'm a little bit lost.
Okay, where are you lost? That's good. That's cool. I like that.
I don't know.
Tell me where you're lost. Help me out. Do you see the experiment?
Yes.
Okay, so the question was, we have this unicellular algae. We have two different varieties. One has this umbrella-shaped cap, and the other one has this sort of crinkled cap. And that's a particular phenotype. It's like cauliflower and broccoli. And the idea is that there's some genes that control this particular process. And Hamerling wanted to know where the genes were that were responsible for controlling this process, that is the phenotype of this single-celled organism. And in order to do that, he couldn't read it in a book. He had to do an experiment. Okay, and the experiment that he did was he predicted that, at least that was his hypothesis rather, that the genetic information that dictated the phenotype or the shape of the cap resided in the nucleus. And with this unicellular organism, the nucleus resides right down here. And then all the rest of this is just pure cytoplasm. And so he cut this thing off, as you can see right over here, and he took a little bit of the cytoplasm from this brown algae and put it here, and he cut the top off of the brown off and put a little bit of the middle part or the cytoplasm of the green algae on the brown one, but he left the brown nucleus intact and the green nucleus intact, and he allowed these caps to regenerate, because they do regenerate, and he saw that the shape of the cap went with the kind of nucleus in the foot. And he concluded from that that the genetic information resided in the nucleus because something was dictating the shape of the cap. And I said, what's wrong with that conclusion? That could be valid, but what would be another explanation?
I suppose it could be somewhere else
Not
in that
supposing.
Area.
What's your...
It could be somewhere else in that area, and all it shows is that it wasn't in that one area of the cytoplasm that he switched.
Okay, say it again. That's excellent. That's exactly right. What does this experiment show?
It shows that,
that
the genetic material, the genetic information could be in any of that area below, and all it shows is that it was the genetic information is not in that small piece of cytoplasm that he switched.
Exactly. So there's an alternative explanation here. So the bottom line is that
it's
one has
conclusive.
To do other experiments to show this beyond a shadow of a doubt, because there's alternative explanations for this, because the nucleus is buried in this cytoplasm. And down in the bottom is a lot of green cytoplasm and a lot of brown cytoplasm that he left behind. And so therefore it could be the nucleus or the cytoplasm in the bottom. I thought you said you didn't know. You do know. You just have to think it out. So the point is it just can't be the cytoplasm in the part that he transplanted from one algae to the other. Okay. Melissa, what experiment would you do to be able to design an experiment to show unambiguously that the genetic information was in the nucleus? What would you do?
Somehow you would have to switch just the nuclei.
So how would you do it?
Remove them.
So you'd
and
remove
put them
this
in the
nucleus
other...
or destroy it.
And... If you
so
can remove
say,
it and put it in the other one.
Let's say we destroy the green nucleus, and then we would what?
Put that one.
The brown nucleus.
Remove that nucleus and put
and
it in
put it
there.
In there. And let's say we did that experiment, and we got a brown-type fan cap.
Then you would have conclusive evidence that it was the genetic...
Conclusive evidence, Melissa?
I mean...
Beyond a shadow of a doubt?
If you did it multiple times.
Beyond it, what could be a problem with that Easter?
Well, you wanted
it's a good experiment, Melissa. It's the correct experiment. I'll show you that experiment in a second. Go ahead.
Don't you have to test one without a nucleus? And see what
I want to know what's wrong with that experiment conclusion. Or is it correct?
Well, if it only
I didn't ask you to design another experiment. I said, is there an alternative explanation for Melissa's experiment? Karina. It's okay, Easter, you'll get it. What's an alternative explanation? So Melissa suggested a nuclear transplantation experiment. What I'm trying to get you to do is think about science the way a scientist, a good scientist, would think.
Well, you're just
so a good scientist wouldn't say that the genetic information resides in the nucleus. I'll tell you what a good scientist would say, but what's an alternative explanation?
I was just going to ask, are you just taking the
nucleus? Not a question. What's an alternative explanation?
I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah, you do. Come on. Melissa took the nucleus out of the bottom of the cap, out of the bottom of the algae, took it and put it in this enucleated green algae. What could be an alternative explanation? This is very important, what I'm telling you. You're never going to learn this anywhere. You're just going to start reading all these books and accepting everything that you're going to read. But I'm trying to get you not to accept what you read and make your own inferences. So what could be an alternative? Daisy? I know you were yawning, but I saw your hand going up. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that maybe there would be a problem between the species of the...
No. Okay. What could be an alternative explanation? Because she got a positive result. The brown nucleus gave rise to the brown cap. Jennifer?
Could it be that it could just be another thing?
Say it louder.
Another thing in the bottom part of the...
That
causes that? So
that,
you might...
That... Taking the nucleus out of here and we're putting it in there. That's Melissa's
experiment.
So it could
be any of the bottom part. Like, that could be another explanation, so you might...
Not any of the bottom part. You have to be a lot more specific than that for me to give you $1 million for your research.
It might not just be the nucleus. It might be any part that's under the part that you
sectioned. But the part's still there. Melissa took the nucleus and put it over here.
Right, but it could be any of the sections, like not... Just the nucleus? Like
the nucleus is taken out, it's in a little test tube, it's mixed up, and it's put over there. Sam?
Okay, so if there's like proteins in the bottom part surrounding the nucleus, perhaps the proteins in the bottom of the red one would produce that in any nucleus. So if you put any nucleus in there, it's the surrounding proteins.
You're close,
that are...
but you don't quite get it yet. Proteins from where in the bottom, I agree, or whatever.
From the cytoplasm.
But how are they... Melissa took the nucleus out of there.
Yeah.
And she put it here. So.
Well, but that nucleus has been, like, feeding off those specific proteins.
It's been what?
Like, you know.
Nuclei don't feed.
I don't know. I'm an English major. I have no idea. So.
Nuclei don't feed.
Okay.
Go ahead. Nayla.
It's Nejla, but.
Nejla. I'll never get it, but go ahead.
Don't worry. I'll hold it against you.
Appreciate that.
I think that, it may be that you've taken the nucleus out of the brown algae, but you still can't conclude that there's not something in the green foot
that
is leading to that phenotype.
No, the green foot stays there. We haven't done anything with this. We're taking the nucleus and we're putting it over here.
Into the green foot.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So what's the problem? You're all close, but you're just not quite getting it. Sam?
Well, it could just be the proteins in the green part because they haven't moved.
No, but the proteins in the green part would give rise to the little curled algae top. No? Go ahead, Radina. Where's the third one?
Hello.
Put them all together. Everything that you're saying is close. Now put them together.
If there were proteins attached to the nucleus in the brown one, they might have gotten...
Say it louder.
If there were proteins attached to the nucleus in the brown algae, they could have been transferred over with the nucleus to the green one.
Exactly. What if you had contamination of the nucleus by some proteins from the brown algae being attached to the nucleus, and it went with it? It was sort of co-transferred. And so you would never know that by this particular experiment. So what a scientist would say would be what, Melissa? What would be in your paper? What would your conclusion be? Because you will make a conclusion from this experiment, but how would you write it?
That, given the evidence, the... I would conclude that the best...
I would conclude that the most likely explanation is
that the genetic information is in the nucleus, but
however,
it's
I cannot
possible.
Exclude the possibility.
It's not conclusive, and I can't exclude the
no,
possibility
you wouldn't say
that some proteins.
You'd say these experiments strongly suggest that the genetic information resides in the nucleus of this unicellular algae. However, I can't exclude
the possibility
that some contaminant went with the nucleus, and further experiments will be required to resolve that issue. And I think that's exactly
that's
how
say.
It would be written up, and I think that would be very fair, and I think the experiment would be published because it was a landmark in terms of transplantation and stuff, but you've now tempered your conclusion with at least another possibility, and you didn't just dogmatically say, this is what's going on. And that's the way one thinks in terms of doing that, and you need to do another experiment. Well, another experiment was done. Another experiment was done after the Hammerling experiment, a very, very, very famous experiment. One of the most famous experiments in zoology at the time, now animal biology, an experiment not done by Hammerling in algae, but now this was done by individuals by the name of Briggs and King, Mary King and Briggs. And the idea was that if the nucleus has all of the information required to specify an organism, then I should be able to do Melissa's experiment and take that nucleus and put it in an egg that had been enucleated or which the nucleus was destroyed, and then by activating a pseudo-fertilization process, that egg should develop into the organism in which it's destined to specify what it is. This is the origin of cloning, done in 1950, but done for a particular purpose, which was Melissa's experiment, to try and demonstrate that genes reside in the nucleus and that all of the cells of an organism contain the same genes. So just bear with me for a second. So you know what this experiment is. You're going to talk about this with cows and goats and sheep and all kinds of things, and we've talked about this in many ways, but the experiment was to take an egg from a frog, to destroy the egg with ultraviolet light, and there's a reason why ultraviolet light was used, because it destroys the DNA. So the nucleus was destroyed. And then skin cells, the nuclei from skin cells, a skin cell, which is a highly specialized cell, were taken out in Melissa's experiment into a little pipette, and then that nucleus was put inside that egg, and that egg was then stimulated, and I'm not going to tell you how, a pseudo-fertilization process occurred to just activate the development of this now zygote, immature embryo, into an embryo and eventually into a tadpole and occasionally into a frog. And I'm not going to go through all the technical problems and difficulties, but the bottom line is that the Briggs and King experiment was successful, meaning skin cells could direct, skin cells, Brian, could direct the production of a frog. That's a pretty remarkable observation for 1952. That you could take a skin cell nucleus, stick it in the egg of a frog, and get frogs out of it. And all of those frogs would be clones. And that was the first animal cloning experiment, because all the frogs are derived from all of these nuclei, from these skin cells, are clones of each other, because they contain identical genetic information. And if you do this experiment many, many, many times, you could say that maybe there's this contaminant from a protein, but most likely, the probable cause of this, most likely, is genetic information in the nucleus. But more than that, it also says that the skin cell, which is a highly specialized cell, meaning skin cells don't, you know, give rise to little babies and little offspring, but it says that all the genes that have the potential to create an organism are present in the skin cells. And that's the origin of animal cloning. And then it took about 45 years to be able to do that with mammals. This is a frog, and people used to think, oh, it's a frog, you only can do it with frogs, but then we've shown that you can do it with horses and goats and sheep and probably humans. For the point of view of these experiments, the conclusions were that the genetic information that programs an organism resides most likely in the nucleus. And furthermore, that all of these cells in this animal, let's say, even though they're highly specialized and do different things, because an eye cell does something different than a skin cell, does something different than a hair cell, they contain all of the genes. They contain the potential to give rise to the entire organism, which means that all of the genetic information and all the wiring and all the networking that can give rise to a creature resides in any nucleus inside any cell of an organism, irrespective of whether it's a skin cell or a heart cell or a kidney cell or whatever. And that's a principle that stood the test of time in many different organisms. And I should also add that in this experiment, Melissa and Sam and Radina, the nuclei were washed so that any contamination from any protein was washed away, at least as far as they could do the experiment in those days, without destroying its contents. And so there were procedures in which one could isolate these nuclei and then wash them a little bit so they get rid of the things that stick to it. And so these two classical experiments gave rise to some pretty profound conclusions. And they were both done before Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, but in the same time period, which perhaps helped their thinking, although not as much as you would like to think. But clearly, those experiments gave rise to what we now know as the age of mammalian reproduction, the age of being able to clone mammals, as you'll talk about in discussion tomorrow, and already have, the ability to genetically engineer mammalian cells in culture and take those cells and make clones from those cells that are genetically engineered. There were some hands. Can you want to raise them again? And Easter, did you have a question? I saw a couple hands over here. Anton, you're happy?
I'm happy.
Nick, you had a question?
You asked it.
Okay, any other questions? Hannah, you have a question? Sky, you have a question? No. Kyle, you have any questions?
Yep.
Pretty neat experiment, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If you lived in 1952 and someone reported in the New York Times that you could clone a frog, what would you think?
I would think that was pretty neat.
Would you think it's pretty amazing?
Yes, I would.
How would you respond to it? How would you respond to it? Where's the microphone? Do you think that if you were writing science fiction, you might think about all kinds of interesting things in order to do?
Yes.
What would you think?
With that particular technology?
Yeah, with that technology, what would you do?
Yeah.
Talk in the microphone. You'd think about all kinds of possibility of human clones and
probably
all kinds of stuff, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Little babies, little factories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You'd be thinking about all these monster scenarios, probably. Am I correct or not?
Probably.
Probably. Maybe not, but probably, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you were a writer.
If you were a writer.
Uh-huh.
You'd be paid to come up with ideas,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you'd play, and you can make movies and all kinds of stuff. Did any of those things come about yet?
No.
No, exactly. Nor will they. So, let's go to the heart of the matter. So the question really becomes, and you can see I love talking about this stuff. Most importantly, I don't love talking about it. I love teaching you how to think about it, because it's a different way to think. The way to think is you don't accept these conclusions as absolutes. You come up with alternatives, alternatives that are possible. But then if you come up with alternatives, it's incumbent upon you. In fact, it's your responsibility to design an experiment to show whether or not the alternative is valid or not. And that's an important part of the scientific process. So the question really becomes, so we have genes in the nuclei of higher organisms, probably. Genes on chromosomes, probably. We have this stuff, but Samantha, does this say anything about what the substance of these things are? Could be anything, right? Doesn't say anything whether it's a DNA or RNA or a protein, just something that resides in the nucleus in some particular way. But we don't really know what a gene really is from these experiments. In fact, we learned very little about what a gene really is. Jessica, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And people would be thinking about that. Just leave it, Mike. Just leave it. Don't even worry about it. People will be thinking about that and wondering about what that is. At least a lot of people would be. I would be. So let me tell you how it was discovered that DNA was the genetic material. So there's certain properties of genes that we've gone over, but let me just summarize them before I get into some really neat stuff. First of all, they have to be able to replicate. Secondly, whatever the substance is that genes are should be in all cells of all organisms. Would you agree with that? Can't just have a substance in a mouse that's not in a human being and be the genetic material of humans and mice. It's impossible. Has to be able to direct some instructions to a cell and do a variety of different things. So the point here is that any substance, that is chemical substance, that would be what genes are made of, has to have certain properties. But more than that, Brian, from an experimental point of view, that substance would have to satisfy these predictions, wouldn't it? So whatever experiment you do with trying to test and find out what that substance is, the prediction is that substance has to replicate. The prediction is that substance has to direct a specific instruction to some cell. The prediction is that that substance would be found in all cells of all organisms. And the prediction is that it would be pretty stable. Because if it's not, we wouldn't be here, correct? So these would be all the predictions. Yeah.
I see why we would need it to have replication and stability, but why it needs to be universal, I mean, why would that would be like a premise or something that...
So what do you think? Let's not ask why. What do you think?
I mean, it seems to me...
So what I want you to do here, it's really a valid issue you raised. But now I want you to raise it not as a why question. I want you to raise it as an alternative possibility.
Okay.
That's the way to do it. So raise another hypothesis, an alternative hypothesis. Because
an alternative hypothesis is there's something unique or indigenous to each specific species that would make their nucleus produce different, replicate differently than from, than a different species. That way, it would keep, the same.
Okay. So
genes going through.
So let me restate. May I restate your hypothesis? Your alternative hypothesis is there's a different chemical substance in different organisms, each of which has these same properties, and these different chemical substances, they're very different from each other, are able to be the substance of genes because they all have this similar kind of property. That's your alternative explanation. And so that would say that maybe mice have a different molecule that's the substance of a gene, and humans have a different molecule that's the substance of the gene, but substance A can replicate, and substance A can direct instructions to the cell and all that. Is that your alternative?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, the question really wouldn't be why. That's not the way you would want to say that. You'd come up with an alternative. Now, when you formulated that alternative, it might be very difficult to test, because you might have formulated that alternative at a time in which the techniques don't exist to connect that, to suggest that, okay? But you know of experiments that we talked about over the last 2 weeks that show that that's not the case, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, but let's just go back in time. So let's just say you're Bob Goldberg and you're working in a lab, 100 hours a week, and now you're living in 1920 and someone raises this possibility. Or it wouldn't be 1920, actually, probably about 1940, someone raised this possibility. What would you think the simplest possibility would be? The simplest. The simplest.
And explaining what?
What molecule is the genetic material? We have two hypotheses on the floor. One, there's a universal molecule that's the genetic material, which we now know as DNA. The alternative is your hypothesis is each organism no matter how closely related to each other, has a different molecule. That's the hereditary substance. That's your alternative. What's the simplest possibility?
I'd suppose...
Not suppose. What's the simplest possibility?
The non-universal approach.
You think non-universal is simple. So that would say that mice are derived independently of, let's say, pigs and goats and cows, and humans are derived. All these organisms have originated completely independently of each other. Or alternatively, perhaps all of these organisms had some common ancestral organisms and were derived from them, and therefore, as you start and have, you know, one organism that gives rise to a bunch of other organisms, that whatever the genetic material was here resides in these organisms here.
You're saying that's more intuitive to think that?
No, I'm asking what's simpler. Simpler just to have all these organisms that are just completely originating independently of each other?
Or I think intuitively, yeah, you'd think the latter.
You think this. Okay? Who thinks that the hypothesis on the left is simpler than the hypothesis on the right? Sam? Easter? How many think it's more complicated? In making creatures on the face of this earth, what would be more difficult? To make a mouse independently of a pig? So that might be a mouse, a pig, a goat, sheep, horse, elephant, to make all those creatures completely independently of each other, or perhaps to have some common mammal back here, and that would radiate in some way and give rise to those variety of creatures. I mean, it could have gone either way. I mean, your hypothesis is valid, but what might be the simplest way in which this would occur? Rebecca. No, what was the simplest?
The simplest way would be...
In your opinion.
In my opinion, it would be the evolution from the common ancestor. But wasn't, I mean, Darwin's theory was already out there that plants...
At that particular time, Darwin's...
Idea,
it wasn't a theory, but it was a hypothesis. It was out there. Okay? We'll have to talk about theories and hypotheses because they're used in very wrong ways. The simplest is called Occam's razor. Generally, the simplest, not always, generally the simplest explanation is usually the explanation that comes to fruition. Not always, but usually it's the simplest process.
Oh, okay.
In science,
the question I had, though, is that you're starting this with like 4 points, and one of them is that universality, you're assuming that is Occam's razor, that it is the, you know, the most intuitive, simplest answer, but I thought it was a big deal when, you know, Darwin came out with that it could, you know, have similar ancestry, that actually the intuitive, simpler answer, and people just to think about it. I mean, going back, you know, to Moses or Noah's Ark, and, you know, he had every different which species.
Noah's Ark isn't science, so let's go.
But I'm saying
science.
Intuitively, people would think that, you know, they would each come up independently. You know, so I'm saying at this time, where did they come up with the premise that everything would be universal? Is that just from Darwin?
I think that's from a lot of different pieces of evidence, and I think that even in the absence of Darwin, people would probably think that that would be the simplest way creatures would evolve. I mean, if they think about it logically and leave out, you know, Noah's Ark and all these other kinds of things. Generally, when you're doing science, generally the simplest explanation is what you formulate your hypothesis and your predictions on, because they're the easiest to test in a laboratory, and then you could be surprised, which you often are, but it's an easy way to guide experiments. You don't want to start with the most complicated series of experiments. You want to try and do the simplest to come up with an elegant answer. So it's kind of the way the process of science works out.
I think we're talking at cross points, but, you know, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, I don't know, to me it wouldn't seem that would be the simplest answer. And so I'm wondering where they came up with
that
question.
But if you had a context, it might be the simplest answer. So all these things that people are proposing are being proposed in a context with a lot of other knowledge that is going on at the same time.
Okay.
And so it was so like it's not like understood. In a vacuum that someone's, you know, living in 50,000 years ago and seeing a shooting star and saying, why is there a shooting star? There's a context here in which a lot of these things are being guided. Okay. And so, and even if there wasn't a context, the way I would start my experiments and do start my experiments is in the simplest possible case. Because the simplest possible case is how you can really design an experiment and then eliminate all of the different possibilities. If you started with all kinds of complicated things, you can't isolate each one separately from each other and come up with some really neat conclusions. Whether it's correct or not correct is not the issue. It's how you go about testing it. Daisy.
I was just going to say that I think it seems like he's saying that people, that would be the first thing they think of, that different organisms come from with different like things that make up genes. But I think I agree that it's more logical if you consider that we're talking about like genetic material, and if you consider that we're talking about where species come from and like what makes them in that sense, it's more simple to consider that we all come from the same substance that's perhaps differentiated in different ways.
Perhaps, but it could have come out the other way. We just didn't know. You have to do the experiments to choose it. You have to go into the experiments without any prejudice. You have to have a hypothesis, but a hypothesis is not prejudice. A hypothesis is something that guides you, and if the result comes out differently, you have to be open to other possibilities. It's very important from a scientific point of view to have that open mind, or then you'll really miss something and really be, you know, off the mark. In any case, if you think about the genetic material, and you think about how profound it is, and if you think about it, that it had to have arisen at some particular point in time, quite a few billion years ago. And if you think about the fact that it has to be some substance, we talked about that the first day of class, it's not going to be some ether, it's going to be something that's concrete that you can get your hands on, then you want to find out what it is. And so experiments to try and show that DNA was the genetic material trace back about 80 years. And as I said earlier, the march to show that DNA was the genetic material didn't really originate with that particular question. It really originated in the point of view of, let's try and find out what's causing this scourge, which is killing millions and millions of people, literally. I mean, we live in the age of antibiotics. The beginning of the century, in the mid-century, there were no antibiotics. People died of common pneumonia. Point here is that there was a guy by the name of Griffith, and Griffith was a medical microbiologist. And Griffith lived at about 1920, 1925, and he was trying to understand the process by which pneumonia caused lethality, because in those days, pneumonia was a lethal disease. It still is, but we treat it with antibiotics. Unless you have an antibiotic-resistant strain, and then you're really in bad shape. There's not that many antibiotics left anymore in which you can be used to be treated for pneumonia, and it's really a difficult problem. But in those days, they didn't even have the antibiotics, and Griffith was trying to understand this basic process under which pneumonia, Streptococcus pneumoniae, a bacteria, killed humans, mice, and all mammals. The origins of genetic engineering go back to Griffith's experiment. Before I tell you what that experiment is, I want to tell you that he had nothing to do with genetic engineering. He did not know what he found. He did not understand his discovery. He had no insight into what his discovery meant in any way, shape, or form. He just had observations that he did not understand, observations which were quite startling. And so I want you to go along with me when I discuss this experiment because it's really nifty. And without this experiment and another one, which I'll talk about, Watson and Crick would have never discovered the structure of DNA. And furthermore, genetic engineering would have really never been invented, because what Griffith did, although he never knew it, was carry out the first genetic engineering experiment that was ever conducted, that is using DNA, even though he didn't know anything about what he was doing. But in retrospect, it was pretty elegant. So Griffith was working with a bacteria, and you know that bacteria are single-celled entities. very different than eukaryotes, which are multicellular entities. And in fact, the bacteria that he's working with were down here. And they're, you know, billions of years apart from humans and other higher eukaryotic organisms. And furthermore, there's a typical bacteria, and I think you know that, but just to review it, typical bacteria has a chromosome with maybe 2,000 to 5,000 genes. Typical bacteria has a chromosome that's a circle. Generally, it's one chromosome in the bacteria and has the shape of a circle generally. There are exceptions to that rule, but the exceptions are very rare and few and far between. Generally, the chromosome is attached to the cell wall of the bacteria, generally. That helps the bacteria divide, which I'm not going to get into at this particular point, but I will next week. And generally, this bacteria has no nucleus. It has no membranous organelles. It doesn't have a nucleus. It doesn't have mitochondria. It doesn't have anything other than a chromosome and some cytoplasm and some protein synthesizing machinery, which are called ribosomes, that we'll get to next week. And the chromosome is reasonably big. Again, it's many nucleotides in circumference, and it's a circle. But there are these things in here called plasmids, which weren't discovered until the 1970s. And as you know, or should know, plasmids can carry antibiotic resistance genes. And this is why we get resistance to antibiotics, because these little plasmids are always evolving, and they're being transferred very easily between bacteria and natural populations in sewers. And you find resistant plasmids most frequently in the water supplies coming out of hospitals. That's where you find the most resistant bacteria, because these plasmids are always evolving to beat the antibiotics that are there to kill them. Generally, the plasmids contain anywhere from 1 to 100 to 200 genes. There are some very big plasmids, and you're going to read and talk about a very big plasmid for discussion tomorrow. It's the plasmid in this pathogen that infects plants, which is the basis of plant genetic engineering, called Agrobacterium tumefaciens, and it has a very large plasmid, which is the basis of all plant genetic engineering, which has approximately 100 to 150 genes. But in the case of, let's say, the common gut bacteria that's used for cloning and recombinant DNA, those plasmids are relatively small, and they contain maybe 3, 4, 5 genes at the most. But they're extra chromosomal circular pieces of DNA that replicate and divide independently of the main bacteria. And Griffith's bacteria, the Streptococcus pneumoniae, has a structure that just looks almost exactly like this. And I'm not going to get into the sizes. It's very small. The size of a bacteria is about the size of a nucleus in a human cell. The size of a bacteria is about the size of a nucleus in a human cell. It's pretty small. And the number of genes that a bacteria have is approximately 1/10 the number of genes you find in human chromosomes. So obviously, bacteria uses fewer genes than we have in our nuclei, because we carry out a lot more different processes, and it's a lot more complicated than that. But generally, there's about 10% of the genes in a bacteria that a normal human contains. And furthermore, these bacteria are among some of the most lethal, toxic organisms on the face of this earth. Anthrax, cholera, diphtheria, pneumonia, plague, leprosy, Lyme disease, syphilis, gonorrhea, many of which, botulism, many of these things contain toxins which are totally lethal. 1, 2, or 3 molecules of botulinum toxin, you know as Botox, is lethal. Clostridium botulinum, that's the toxin that people get these Botox that paralyzes you. And it's a lethal, lethal toxin. And so many of these bacteria cause very, very, very serious and horrific diseases. And many of these bacteria are of a major concern now because of chemical and biological warfare and all of those other kinds of things. So the question then becomes, how is it demonstrated that DNA was the genetic material, because it is DNA, and how did it start? And so let me take you on a journey into Griffith's experiment. And it's neat. So bacteria have genetic variability in populations, just like all of us. And so Griffith was working with this Streptococcus pneumoniae, of which the genome has now been sequenced. You can go on the internet, much like you did for your quiz for last week, and you can find the sequence of the Streptococcus pneumoniae. It has about 2,000 to 3,000 genes. It's a very small chromosome. Half the number of genes is the E. coli in your gut, and the E. coli that you were streaking on this plate, because you were streaking E. coli bacteria. And furthermore, what Griffith observed was that there were two kinds of strains of Streptococcus pneumonia bacteria. A virulent strain in which when it's infected in a mouse, the mouse dies from sepsis. And what sepsis means is that the bacteria just completely duplicate, go through the bloodstream, take hold of every single solitary organ system, and you have complete organ failure. And sepsis is a major killer in human beings from bacterial infections. And in fact, if you get beyond the point in which the bacteria is spread through your bloodstream, I don't care how many antibiotics you get piped into you, you're going to die. It's a very serious disease. Staph infections, very common bacteria, can cause sepsis and lead to unfortunate lethality. So what Griffith noticed was that there are two strains, a virulent strain and an avirulent strain, one that didn't cause any infection in these mice that he was working with. But he noticed when he looked under the microscope that those two strains had very different morphologies. One of them had this sort of smooth, shiny capsule, which he didn't know was made of sugar, but we now know is made of sugar. It's a coat of sugar, and it was smooth. And he knew that the smooth bacteria were virulent, lethally virulent, to mice and to humans. And he also knew that the avirulent variety was rough, as you can see in this very crude picture. It didn't have this smooth capsule around it. So the rough was avirulent and didn't cause any disease. The smooth was virulent and caused lethality. And of course, the hypothesis was that the smooth coat, the capsule, protected the bacteria from the immune system of the host, in this case, the mouse, and therefore the mouse came down with an infection, and the mouse was killed, or the human beings. So he's getting at what the basis of this lethal disease is that is causing all kinds of problems in human populations. And again, I'm not talking about 10 deaths. Josh, I'm not talking about 100 deaths. I'm not talking about thousands of deaths. I'm talking about millions, literally millions of people. And so that's what he was working on. And he also observed that in his laboratory, the virulent strain could mutate spontaneously to the avirulent strain, and the avirulent strain, Sam, could mutate to the virulent strain. And so he could show that one strain was derived from each other. And you could have a mutation that would go in one direction and a mutation that will go in another direction spontaneously, just like red cabbage and green cabbage. We're getting probably allelic differences in the genes that specify this coat, and that's true. And I'm not going to tell you what this coat is made of. It's a fascinating story. But the point is it's made up of sugars. And if you have a defect in any of the gene that makes up these sugars, you don't make the sugar, you don't have the coat. If you don't have the coat, the immune system of the mouse can produce antibodies. The antibodies can bind to the coatless bacteria and destroy it. But the antibodies don't destroy the bacteria that have this coat around it, and it's completely immune to the antibodies. Not antibiotics, antibodies. And that's why it's lethal. And so we have this genetic variability in the population of lethal pneumonia bacteria in which the rough bacteria don't cause any infection, the smooth bacteria cause lethal infection, and Griffith recognized this at that time. Sommer, why do you think that Griffith would have been intrigued by this at that particular time? You know, we're talking about 1925 now. Would you be intrigued if you saw that at that particular time, 80 years ago? What would cause you to be intrigued?
Well, if you could figure out what made the smooth bacteria rough, you could make a very lethal disease not lethal.
Exactly.
You can save a lot of lives.
Exactly. And that's what Ritha was working on. If you could figure out why the rough was rough and the smooth was smooth, if you could figure out how to make the rough, the smooth rough, then you could save a lot of lives in some way, if you could figure that all out, which was way beyond what they could do at that particular time. Because, frankly, Griffith knew very little about genes because they were just being discovered this time. Certainly didn't know anything about genes and bacteria. No one else knew. But it might cause you to do some experiments, right? And some experiments that might not have any sense because you didn't really know what you were working with, correct? Because you don't have anything to guide you, in a sense. You're sort of doing what's called empirical experiments. Now you're not guided by hypothesis. It's called empiricism. You're just doing an experiment to look for an observation, but in reality you're not guided by a specific hypothesis. And that's what Griffith did. And he did this crazy experiment for which to this day it's published. You can read it in the Journal of General Medical Physiology, 1925. You can get it in the library here and read it if you want. But the point is he did this crazy experiment that didn't make a lot of sense of what he was doing. But here's what happened. He took this smooth bacteria, which was virulent, and had this capsule, and he injected it into the mouse, and the mouse died. That was one control. When you do experiments, you always have to have a control. Okay? The plate that you had today with had no marks on it was your control. Okay? To a certain extent. So that was his control. He knew that the smooth bacteria was going to cause this mouse to die. And that's exactly what happened. And when you do that thing, that's called the positive control, in a sense, because you get a positive result. In experimental biology, you have to have positive controls. Gavino, what have I told you a million times? Never do an experiment without a positive control and a negative control. Am I right or wrong? Exactly. If you don't have that, the experiment's not valid. So he did a positive control. Griffith was a good experimentalist. He knew what he was doing. Didn't know why. So then he did the counter experiment. So the first experiment is positive. It just tells him that the smooth bacteria that he was working with works. Told him that when he takes this culture that he's going to be doing his experiment with, it kills the bacteria, which is what he would, the mouse, which is what he would predict it. But then he took the rough bacteria. This rough bacteria was derived from the smooth bacteria. It wasn't an independent rough bacteria. It wasn't something he got in a different place. It was this smooth bacteria mutated in his lab into this rough avirulent bacteria. So the rough was derived from the smooth. That's important. And he took that experiment, he did the negative control, meaning, depending on how you look at it, meaning that the rough bacteria injected into the mouse, nothing happened. That mouse was going around and eating and doing what it likes to do and was fine. And now Griffith's pretty happy because now he can do the experiment. But here was the crazy experiment. He took the smooth bacteria and he boiled it. He boiled it to about 95, 100 degrees. And he injected it into the mouse, and the mouse lived. And so Griffith hypothesized, and he was correct, that you could kill this pneumonia bacteria by heating it, kind of like sterilization, pasteurization process. So you could kill the bacteria by heating and boiling it, which is what he did. But now he did the crazy experiment. And this is the nub of it. Josh, he took dead, smooth bacteria. They were dead. He knew that because he had done part three. He knew that he killed them and nothing happened to the mouse. And he mixed these dead, virulent bacteria, for who knows what reason, because there's no record of his thought process, he mixed them with live. I'm going to say that again. He mixed the dead, smooth bacteria. Dead, smooth, virulent bacteria. He mixed the dead, smooth, with live, avirulent rough. So now we have live bacteria mixed with dead bacteria. Now, what I would have predicted, and probably what Griffith would have predicted, is what would have happened, Josh? from his experiment. Microphone. Microphone, Mike.
There would have been no effect on the mouse?
Logically, wouldn't you conclude that from this experiment?
Yes.
How many would agree that from this experiment there would be no effect on the mouse? However, that's exactly what he didn't get. That mouse croaked every single solitary time he did it. Now, when you did that experiment, Josh, back in 1925, and you did it, what would you have concluded first time around? Think like a scientist now. What would have been your first conclusion?
I would have concluded that...
Your first conclusion. Or your first thought. Gets back to what we were talking about on Thursday.
Something in the smooth strain that didn't need to be alive got transferred to...
Would that be your first thought?
Oh, there's going to be a contamination issue?
Yeah.
Maybe not all of the
bacteria.
What's
your first thought? There'd be some contamination issue, maybe. So you do it over again. Do it over again. Do it over again. You can never rule out this contamination, but if you have a culture of bacteria, you can say within pretty good probability, maybe, but you can never rule it out. But you can say pretty well. We'll show you how I can rule it out in a second, okay? But the point here is that that might be the first thing is maybe I contaminated something. Then after you repeated it about 15 times, what might be, and did it from a single bacteria cell that you isolated specifically in a chamber that was sterile, and you knew there was one cell, and you pulled that one cell out, and you burned everything and sterilized everything to the best of your ability, and you still got this result, what might you conclude second?
That there was something inanimate in the heat-killed S strain that still got transferred to the R strain and in turn produced a killer effect.
And what would you call that stuff?
I would call it the...
What would you name it? It became a very famous name.
A gene?
No, I didn't know about genes. You use this word all the time on your quizzes. You use it all the time.
I don't know.
It's a very famous word. What do you think, Rebecca? Becca. What did Griffith conclude? It's a really nifty experiment. What did he conclude? He said that the rough strain was somethinged into something. That something started with a T.
Transformation?
Yes, that's exactly what he said. He said the rough strain was transformed into a smooth strain by a transforming principle which is yet to be understood and discovered. And that's exactly what he said. So Griffith invented the word transformation, which is one of the most important words in genetic engineering. We use it all the time. You know, E. coli was transformed by the plasmid. These goats were transformed by the growth hormone gene. The humans were transformed by the good adenine deaminase gene, et cetera, et cetera. And out of transformation came a very other important word called transgenic. Transgenic plants, transgenic animals, transgenic bacteria, transgenic came from transformation. And another word called transfection arose, where you take DNA and you put it into a single cell. It'd be called transfection. Now it's called transformation, but they both have the same meaning. That's what Griffith did. Okay. Now, what are the possibilities here, Brian? What are the possibilities for this inanimate substance? So what are now the possibilities? You think that after this paper was published that people would want to know what the transforming principle was?
Yes.
Okay, so what are the possibilities?
There could have been something present in the heat-killed S-strain.
What are the possibilities?
There's something in the heat-killed S-strain
that... I know there's something, but what are the possibilities of what that something is?
There's a protein in the heat-killed S-strain that activates...
Okay, so there's protein. What else could it be?
Genetic material like DNA or...
What else could it be? There's protein. What else could it be? I want you to think now.
Chromosomal material from the S-strain.
I don't know what chromosomal material is, and I know that Griffith would never know what chromosomal material is.
Mm-hmm. Genes from the S?
He wouldn't know what genes were either. Proteins he'd know.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the other possibilities here? So we have proteins. What else do we have? What are the other possibilities? Charles.
I don't know what he knows.
What do you know? What are the possibilities?
Well, I knew genes too, but...
Yeah, but that's not a substance. A gene is not a substance.
Like,
what are the possibilities? We have
the nucleus?
What could be the transforming principle molecule?
Nucleic acids?
Could be a nucleic acid, right? What else? Charles?
Protein. He said protein.
Could be a protein. What else?
The cytoplasm?
No, it's not a molecule. What else? Euditha.
Maybe an enzyme of some sort?
And that's a protein.
That's a protein.
What else could it be?
Okay.
What are the molecules inside cells? So we have proteins and nucleic acids. It's all in chapter 1 and 2 in your text. We have proteins and nucleic acids. What else do we have?
That's an organelle. It's not.
What else do we have? Substances in a cell. James, what do we have? What are the possibilities?
Besides nucleic acids.
We have nucleic acids. We have proteins. What else do we have?
Cell?
Yeah. What would be in a bacterial cell that could be the transforming principle? Is there an infinite number of different molecules inside the cell? Would we argue that it might be a big molecule? It's not going to be a sugar, probably. It has to be something that's directing some drastic phenotype, like taking something from rough to smooth and killing the mice. So it's going to be complicated, theoretically.
Yeah, so... Wait,
so
I can't
so what could it be?
I can't say plasmids, right?
That's a that's yeah. Not a substance.
So maybe
what is a plasmid?
Plasmids are the DNA strains that probably transformed it, I think.
Okay, so we already said nucleic acid, protein, what else?
Maybe like sugars or something.
Would you think it'd be a little simple sugar like a glucose could be something that'd be able to dictate a complicated biological function like this? It's possible, but what would you think?
Probably not.
Probably not, exactly. So what are the other possibilities? What are the other large molecules inside cells that you guys eat every single solitary day? Patricia, I know every day you eat these things. How many genes did you eat today? What kinds of things do you eat that be inside a cell? Say that. Say it.
Lipids.
Lipids. It's a big molecule made up of fatty acids. So they're inside. So it could have been a lipid. I want you all to be very careful now because there's something that you're missing in my sort of instructions of teaching you how to think critically. Proteins, nucleic acids, lipids. What else? Ben?
Carbohydrates.
Carbohydrates. Polysaccharides, sugars. No, you guys eat these things. So the possibilities for the transforming principle would be a big molecule inside the cell called macromolecules. Is that correct? How many agree with that? No? How many would disagree? What's an alternative explanation here, Shauna?
An alternative explanation.
Yeah, there's something being missing. There's something missed here. We're saying that there's these molecules in the bacteria that somehow were transferred from the bacteria to the mouse, okay, and caused the mouse to croak.
Well, the R cells still exist in, you know, functioning, correct?
What's being missed here? What would be an alternative?
An alternative for...
What are we forgetting about?
You mean in addition to the four macromolecules?
Or whatever, in terms of what could be the transforming principle. What have we forgotten about?
What about, the cell?
What have we forgot about?
We have the cell wall.
What have we forgot about? Cell wall's polysaccharide.
Okay.
Sorry, okay, what have we forgot that. About? Brian. What have we forgot about? Yeah, anything could be possible. What have we forgot about? Taking these bacteria and what's being done in this experiment, Brian. You know I could just tell you what all this is and give you the experiment and just show you and design it and outline it, but that's no fun. It's much more fun this way. What else could it be? How was the experiment done? I want you all to be thinking about this. It's not I know it's not maybe on, but it's not Go ahead.
Okay, anyway, on the experiment, what he did was the heat.
What could be the alternative?
Like the heat might have done something.
Could be? What happened here? He took this mixture of smooth plus rough, dead and live, and he injected it into this mouse. What's another possibility? Jordan. Maybe we'll get you away from doodling and thinking about the experiment. What's another possibility?
Well, there could be...
Think about the design of the experiment. Yes, it's true. It could be a molecule from the bacteria, and it could be, carbohydrates or polysaccharides or whatever. That's absolutely true.
Could it be something that the bacteria produces?
But again, it would be nucleic acid, protein, lipid, polysaccharide, or something else, yes. But what are we forgetting here? It's one thing that we're forgetting. Becca? If you're really thinking critically, really critically.
Is there a possibility that the S cells can come back to life of some sort?
Or what could be another possibility? Go ahead. Radina. I know it's far-fetched, but what could be another possibility?
Well, couldn't the rough cells have mutated?
That's an absolute possibility. Thank you. But if you repeated this over and over again, mutation would be at a very low frequency, correct? So you'd expect that only to occur very rarely, maybe 1 out of 10 million times. What's another possibility? I know I'm belaboring this, but I want you to try and think about all the possibilities. You've completely eliminated one. Easter? What's another possibility? It's on the board here.
Another source, out of the list?
Pardon? So we said it could be contamination. We probably ruled that out. Mm-hmm. We said that it could be mutation, which is a wonderful explanation. That could be ruled out because it's so rare, and this occurs at a very high frequency. What's another possibility?
I'm confused. How is mutation different from transformation?
What's another possibility? We'll get to that. What's another possibility?
Maybe some of the genes or whatever from the...
Yuditha, what's another possibility?
That the rough absorb the dead small somehow and...
Okay,
the dead
let me
smooth.
Give you some clues because I don't want to spend 20 minutes more on this. What is in the design of the experiment? Show me. Dead smooth bacteria.
Right.
Is everyone with me? We have dead smooth bacteria. We have live, rough bacteria.
Right.
We also have a mouse.
Is it?
You haven't eliminated the possibility that transforming principle is coming from the mouse.
Yeah.
Have you?
Okay.
The mouse is there. It's part of the experiment. You haven't eliminated that somehow the live, rough, and the smooth, dead is interacting with something in the mouse in some way. You'd never know it was doing it because the dead... Smooth is just dead. The live rough is live, but when you mix them together, maybe something happened and the mouse contributed to something. That's a possibility, isn't it? We're talking about 1920. It's a possibility. I mean, you can't eliminate that possibility when you're thinking about something as revolutionary as something that was dead, transforming something that was live into something that's now going to kill millions of people. Could have been the mouse. Matt? Pardon?
Something in the mouse brought the smooth cells back to life?
I wouldn't say something in the mouse brought the smooth cell back to life, but let's say something in the mouse was able to maybe release something from the smooth cells or contribute to it or add to it or combine with something or whatever, make some new combination. Mouse plus smooth plus rough caused something to happen. Can't eliminate that possibility. Charles?
Would it matter in what order the bacteria were? Like, if you were to in number two, when he just adds the live rough and nothing happens, and then if you were to later add the dead smooth to the one that survived, would that still kill it? Or
don't know.
Okay, so he never tested that?
I don't know. So you can't eliminate the mouse. So how will you eliminate the mouse, Easter? That's a possibility. Does everyone agree that's a possibility? Something from the mouse. How are you going to eliminate that possibility? What would you do? How would you design an experiment to eliminate that possibility? Go ahead.
Did you try it with different animals?
Or try it. What's the difference between the smooth and the rough?
Put on a sugar coating.
What's the difference between the smooth and the rough and how they look? What's the phenotype of the rough?
It doesn't have a coat on it.
Right, and what's the phenotype of the smooth?
It has a coat.
So couldn't you possibly take this dead smooth bacteria, mix it with live rough bacteria, streak it on a plate like you guys did today, and look under the microscope and see that you get smooth bacteria that's alive and replicating. Mm-hmm. Okay? And if you did that experiment, there's no mouse.
Right.
And now what would you conclude?
That it does make it, does transform it.
And what's it a property of the transforming principle, Sommer? Yeah, what's the transform? We have this thing called the transforming principle. What would be, is it inherent property of what? Is it the mouse or is it the bacteria cells?
The bacteria cells.
Exactly, it's the bacteria cells. So we've now eliminated the possibility of the mouse contributing to the transforming principle because you can do transformation without having a mouse. So now what are the possibilities, Ben? What molecule in the bacteria could be the transforming principle?
Any of the four listed on the board?
Or maybe some others, but let's just suppose that it has to be a large molecule because it's a complicated genetic process. Remember that we're transforming the rough into smooth, and that smooth is being... I'll come back to your question, Easter. I haven't forgotten about you. We're transforming the rough into smooth, and the smooth is being inherited from generation to generation to generation. So it's something that's inherited. So that means it's something that's genetic. So what's the difference between transformation and mutation? So mutation, the rough to smooth and smooth to rough occurred what? Can't hear you. Grab the microphone. Mike, I need some help with the microphones. Yeah, so go ahead. Can you turn it on? One of the reasons I need you to use the microphone is I can't hear. Go ahead.
Okay. It happens spontaneously?
And would you expect it to be rare or?
Well, it's not rare because it happens on every time they do this experiment.
Well, I guess rare is relevant. But would you expect mutation to be a rare event?
Mm-hmm. But this case, it wasn't happened.
And in this case, so mutation is a spontaneous thing that happens where you change one phenotype to another phenotype. Mm-hmm. And is inherited, change in the genetic material. But in this case, we had to mix things together,
right?
Correct?
And it happened every single time, so it's not like a chance.
And it's pretty high frequency.
Uh-huh.
So in this case, we use the live rough to be transformed into smooth by these dead smooth. So in a sense, there was a, it was just called a transformation. The phenotype was transformed by some process that was used, and this process was the mixing of these things together.
Right.
Okay. So we eliminated mutation as a possibility. We eliminated the possibility of the fact that it could be the mouse. And Griffith published his stuff in 1925. So the question remained then, what was the... Becca, do you have a question? Delighted.
I just had a question. Because he did the first two steps by doing like the kind of two controls, doesn't that eliminate the possibility that's coming from the mouse? Or do you mean that the two combine plus the mouse?
Yeah, so it's like A plus B equals D. It's like A plus B equals D.
Okay.
So the first two experiments was just A. Second experiment was B. Okay. But then he mixed those two together, and he got something totally different.
Okay.
And maybe the mouse contributed something to make it totally different.
Okay.
So now 20 years go by. And there's a very famous guy who you saw a picture of in the film that was shown by Mike and Gloria in discussion by the name of Oswald Avery. How many of you read that name when you read the double helix? Because he's very prominent in the double helix. Avery. A-V-E-R-Y. Maybe you didn't pay attention to the names, but it's a very, very prominent name. And Oswald Avery and his colleagues, Avery, McLeod, and McCarty, and McCarty just died, and I have it in your handout, and I had the fortune to have lunch with him not too long ago at a National Academy of Sciences meeting before he died, an amazing guy. He was a sole survivor of this experiment. He died in his late 90s, very lucid at, you know, at the time I talked with him. What did these people do? Well, I can't go into all the things that they did, but it was pretty amazing. They were at the Rockefeller Institute, which is now Rockefeller University in New York. And Avery and his colleagues, which were just junior fellows and graduate students, set out to try and show what was the transforming principle. And they tried to show what was the transforming principle at a time in which people didn't know very much about DNA and proteins and RNA and lipids and polysaccharide. And it was Avery that demonstrated that the sugar coat of the pneumonia bacteria was, in fact, polysaccharide, carbohydrates. He demonstrated that. It was Avery and his group that demonstrated that you didn't need the mouse to have transformation. And it was Avery that carried out one of the perhaps most classical experiments in molecular biology and genetic engineering of the 20th century. And it was Avery et al.'s experiment that led Watson and Crick, beyond a shadow of a doubt, think that DNA was the genetic material. And without Avery's experiment, Watson and Crick would have never thought about that, nor would anybody else. And what did Avery did? He tested the hypothesis that the transforming principle was a molecule inside the cell of the dead, rough bacteria. That was the hypothesis, that there was some molecule, a big molecule, because they thought that genes were complicated. They didn't think genes were simple. And they thought that the molecule, the substance of the gene, had to be a relatively complicated substance. And so what Avery did was to say, hypothetically, that the transforming principle is a molecule inside the bacterial cell. And it could either be protein, RNA, DNA, lipids, polysaccharides. They'd already showed that you don't need the mouse. They showed that you don't even need a cell. They showed experimentally that just an extract from these dead smooth bacteria could transform live rough into smooth. So they knew you didn't have to have a live mouse. They knew you didn't have to have a live cell. All you needed to have was an extract from these dead bacteria. It was all done experimentally until they purified by inventing the techniques to purify DNA. The spooling technique that you guys used to show the DNA had its origins in Avery's experiments in the 1940s. They had to invent methods to get these molecules out of these cells in relatively pure form. And so Avery's experiment was carried out in the 40s. And what they did was take live rough cells and individually, in individual experiments, mix these live rough cells with purified smooth polysaccharides, purified smooth lipids, purified smooth RNA, purified smooth protein, as much as they could purify, purified smooth DNA. And in every single solitary case, no transformation was observed. So RNA could not transform smooth, could not transform live rough into smooth. Polysaccharides could not transform live rough into smooth. Carbohydrates could not transform live rough into smooth. And the only thing that could do it was this extract of DNA from this boiled, dead bacteria. Law, does that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that DNA is the genetic material?
Yes, with repeat.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt?
Well, I guess.
What have we been talking about?
No. Because
so what could have been purified along with the DNA? Remember we talked about it in the hammer.
Would protein still be
there? Could have been a little bit of protein that you'd never detect. There could have been a little bit of RNA that you'd never detect by any measurement that was available. So it's possible that the genetic material simply from this experiment could have been something else that might have been present in such a minute amount that you wouldn't be able to detect it. So how would you eliminate that possibility? Well, Avery did it in perhaps the most classical way that anyone could ever imagine for this particular period of time. He did what an excellent scientist would do, in that he was skeptical. He said, yes, this experiment suggests, Melissa, but does not show that the DNA is the genetic material. And so they designed in another experiment. What are these things, Yuditha, called enzymes? And are enzymes specific for particular molecules?
Yes.
So a restriction enzyme does what? Does a restriction enzyme bind to RNA?
Yes.
RNA?
No, DNA. It cuts DNA.
Does it digest proteins?
No.
So it's very specific for the bond that holds the nucleotides together.
Yes.
The phosphodiester bonds.
Yes.
So if you had a hypothesis, Loda, that maybe there's a contamination of this DNA by protein. If you mix this DNA with an enzyme that degrades protein, what would you expect? What would your prediction be?
That you'd have a pure enough for.
If you hypothesized that your transformation was due to a contamination.
Oh, that it was due, so it was due to the protein?
Right. And you used an enzyme that was specific for protein and destroyed protein, what would you expect? What would you predict?
It wouldn't have the live.
That you wouldn't get transformation.
Yes, it wouldn't transform.
Okay, so Avery did that experiment. He purified enzymes that degraded proteins. He purified enzymes that degraded lipids. He purified enzymes from these smooth bacteria and other things that degraded RNA. And he did all those experiments. And he still was able to take the DNA and get transformation. So what's the last experiment that he did that would nail the coffin on it, so to speak?
That all showed that the DNA still transformed?
Yeah, it still transformed. We degraded protein, so there's no protein contaminant. We degraded polysaccharides, no polysaccharide contaminant, because the enzymes would get rid of them all. They're very sensitive molecules.
Then do another experiment with the DNA.
And what would you predict?
That would transform.
That it would?
Yeah, you said everything else
didn't work and you got transformation.
Oh, that it did transform. Oh, then that it wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what Avery did. He took an enzyme called DNase, kind of like a restriction enzyme, but not, that's specific for all the phosphodiester bonds in the nucleus, in the molecule, and he used it, and lo and behold, no transformation. So that showed that DNA was probably the genetic material. Do you think, Lotta, that Avery concluded that DNA is the genetic material?
No.
What do you think he said at the last sentence of his paper?
But his experiments strongly suggest.
And?
But it's still possible that something could have effect negatively.
Actually,
affected.
He didn't say that.
Oh, so for
because he
just
eliminated all the possibilities.
Okay. Well, then further experimentation wouldn't.
He said, "What's the cardinal principle in science? What do we have to always do with our experiments?" Pardon? We have to repeat them. And so he was a very cautious scientist. And so, and this is really probably the most famous experiment in molecular biology ever. And he said that if these experiments are repeated by others, then DNA has a biological property that'll yet to be understood in guiding the inheritance of organisms. That's what he said, basically, paraphrasing. And that experiment then was published in the late 1940s, and being very good readers of the literature at the time, there was no internet or anything, you had to go to a library to read these things, came to the attention of Watson and Crick and a few others, and it guided their entire thought process. Because at after that particular point in time, people stopped thinking that it could be proteins and started thinking that DNA is probably the genetic material. Not for sure, but probably. Nick?
What year was that?
About 1948, 1947, 48, 49, somewhere in that area. Would everyone agree with that? And so when you read the double helix, you're going to read about Avery. Because without Avery, Watson and Crick would have never thought in a million years that there's a punchline to all this, that DNA was the genetic material. Now, why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this for a very specific purpose. One reason I'm telling you this is because this is a very important experiment, because it did show that DNA was the genetic material. And how did it show that DNA was the genetic material? Because it satisfied certain predictions. The rough cells took up the smooth DNA. What the boiling did was to release the DNA from the smooth cells. That's what the boiling did. It broke the cells open. The rough cells then took the DNA up by this transformation mechanism. The rough DNA then recombined in some way with the chromosome of the smooth cells. And then the smooth cells started to produce a substance that allowed, we'll call it the S protein, that allowed the smooth bacteria to have a coat. And so one satisfied the prediction of a molecule being the genetic material because one, something went into, meaning the DNA, purified DNA into the rough cells and directed a phenotype, which was smooth coat or virulence, pure DNA, exactly the same as the glowfish experiment. Avery took pure DNA, showed it was pure because all the enzymes got rid of everything else, and the DNA was taken up by this rough bacteria, which was live, and it changed the rough bacteria into smooth. So that says that this DNA could direct the production of a specific trait or a phenotype. And secondly, that smooth bacteria was inherited from generation to generation. So that showed that this naked DNA had the principle of replicating, because it wasn't just one generation in which the smooth was smooth. It was millions of generations that the smooth was smooth. So this showed beyond a shadow of a doubt, at least to the thinking of the time and clearly now, that DNA was the genetic material. But furthermore, it satisfied certain hypotheses. And it showed subsequently that this is a universal process, that transformation is not simply between virulent and smooth, but is a process that can be occurring in all bacteria. And in fact, you know it when you do antibiotic resistance with genetic engineering, that you can take an antibiotic-resistant plasmid, treat a non-antibiotic-resistant bacteria with this plasmid, get it to take it up, and now the bacteria becomes antibiotic-resistant. That's transformation. We're transforming antibiotic sensitivity into antibiotic resistance. That's genetic engineering. What Avery did, and Griffith was the first genetic engineering experiment. Avery knew it. Griffith didn't. It wasn't called genetic engineering at the time, but that's what they did. And then it was subsequently shown that any trait in a bacteria could be transformed. into something else. And then it was shown with naked DNA. And then it was showed, and I'm not going to go through this, that you could do that with, as I showed you last week and the week before, the DNA of a higher organism. So you could take pure DNA, whether it's the male gene, whether it's the growth hormone gene, whether it's the glowfish gene or whatever, and you could inject the pure naked DNA into the egg and it'll transform the phenotype of that animal. And I showed you how you do this to get a mighty mouse, and that means, yo, it's in the DNA. There ain't anything else that's important. I'm serious about this, honestly. There's no magic wand. No one's saying anything. It's a pure molecule of DNA, and as I told you a few weeks ago, we can synthesize that DNA from carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. I don't even need the gene. I'll make it in my lab. And I'll get exactly the same result. That's pretty profound. In fact, that's very profound. That you can make a gene from carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen atoms, and a little bit of phosphorus, and create something that you can inject into an egg or a bacteria or a plant and change its genetic composition. That has its origins in Griffith. That's transformation. That word is universal. That word, Griffith's word, transformation, will be in the annals of scientific literature forever. It's immortalized in terms of the experiment that he did. And that's why I'm telling you about his experiment, because that's the origins of genetic engineering. And I would be derelict in teaching any course in genetic engineering without giving the foundation for the entire science. And that's where it came from. And the principle holds true to this particular day, whether it's a mouse, an animal, a human being, or a plant, or a goat, or whatever. And so what I'm saying here, kind of ending this little discussion, is that, in essence, genetic engineering, as I've said many times before, relies on natural cellular processes. It relies on a DNA molecule going into a cell, being taken up by a chromosome in that cell, uniting with that cell's DNA, and replicating along with it by natural DNA replication processes. And it relies on the natural process of how the genetic code transfers information from DNA to protein so that in the end result, in let's say a mouse or a pig, we get this green jellyfish protein being made because the processes, again, are universal. We haven't talked specifically about those processes. You alluded to it a little bit. So what I'm saying is that there's no magic here. And what I'm trying to convey here is whether you do genetic engineering by the classical approach, which is breeding and just mate organisms, you're manipulating the same process. There's nothing intervening here because we can manipulate an animal or a plant classically, and Brian, I can give you the exact same result in 2006 with the gene that was used to do the classical breeding only in my laboratory. So there's no mystery here. In other words, I can make an herbicide-resistant plant the classical way, but I can also isolate that gene that's responsible for that and make it herbicide-resistant the DNA way. We're manipulating the same gene, the same process, and nothing's being intervened here. And that's all been proven experimentally, and all been proven, Sam, because I really appreciate your skepticism, all been proven with people saying, but what about this, what about that, what about that, what about that, what about that, and experiments being done to eliminate those possibilities, and not accepting it at face value, which is what no good scientist would ever do. So, there's no hocus-pocus to genetic engineering. There's no hocus-pocus to transformation. It's a real fact. I'm going to say it again. I can take a gene and create it from carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus. Those are atoms. And I can put those atoms together in specific combinations, and I can get a green pig. And I made the gene in a test tube. and I took it and put it in an egg of a pig, and the pig comes out green. That is really profound. I want you to start really thinking about that. Because no one would have ever believed 10 years ago that anyone could ever do anything like that. And if you think about science changing culture, no one would have ever conceived about that 100 years ago. And if you think about how culture changes with scientific advances, people couldn't conceive of in vitro fertilization, as I said 2 weeks ago, or birth control pills or any of this stuff. And I will speculate for you, even though I'm not going to be around to see it, unfortunately, but I would choose if I could too. I would make a pact with the devil if I could have 2 weeks, 200 years from now, and that's it, and after that go wherever I go. I will take those 2 weeks to see what science is like 200 years from now, any way, shape, or form. Because I would venture to say that 200 years ago, the stuff that I'm showing you now is going to be so primitive, because 200 years ago, all the stuff that we're talking about, no one even dreamed of. And in fact, no one dreamed of sequencing the human genome 10 years ago. So why am I sharing all of this and pontificating and feeling passionate about it, which I do? Because there's an implication to all of this. The implication is that the processes that I'm trying to teach you, not even how to do the science, but how to think about the science and the processes of the science, which I know may seem complicated and perhaps obscure and perhaps a little bit something that you really didn't bargain for, I know all of that, is something that you have to understand in order to appreciate the profoundness of what we're doing in biology in this day and age. Because if you can appreciate the processes by which these things occur, you can at least have a little bit more appreciation and a better informed decision, because I'm telling you about all of this because you're the ones that are going to have to make the decisions on how this stuff is going to be used. And it is going to be used by you, but it's certainly going to be used by your children and grandchildren, and in ways in which we can't predict. We cannot predict how this is going to be used, but it will be used, and it will not be stopped. It will not be stopped. Maybe it'll stop in the United States, but it ain't going to stop in China, and it isn't going to stop in Vietnam, and it isn't going to stop in India, and it isn't going to stop in some other place in the world. Keep that in mind. Science is universal. It's not a dominating effect of the United States of America or Western culture. And because it has such a profound effect, Lotta, because you have the potential of making green people, and I'm not exaggerating, because it's no big deal to take that green fluorescent protein and put it in a human egg. This is something that we all need to think about philosophically. We need to think about ethically. We need to think about from a moral point of view. And we need to think about all of it. And that's why I'm telling you the story of Griffith and Avery and DNA as the genetic material. Because, and I'm going to end this, because the fruits of their experiments, even though they never knew it or appreciated it, have the potential for transforming humanity, meaning you and I, in ways that we could never, ever, ever have dreamed. And that's something that no one ever considered. And something that all of you and me and the rest of us, but mainly you, because it's not going to be me. You know, I'm going to go off into the sunset in a few years, but it's going to be you. You know, I'll be on the beach in Malibu within 5 years. The point is, it's going to be you guys who are going to be making these decisions and some of you doing some of the experiments. And so that's why it's important to go through these things, because when you understand it, you have a different point of view as opposed to some mystery. Any questions? I know you're all dying to go to the bathroom, so am I. Even though my prostate is probably a little bit larger than yours, we ought to do an experiment to measure that. But the point is, I will see you in some time in discussion tomorrow. Thank you for your attention.